What?
I know how we can run everybody out of Rock Ridge.
How?
We'll kill the firstborn male child in every household.
Too Jewish.
Shalom. Welcome to the Too Jewish radio show and podcast with Rabbi Sam Kohan and friends, a weekly serving of everything Jewish. Get ready for a great hour together, news, music, comedy, and conversation. This morning, Rabbi's guest is Isabella Tabarovsky, author of Be a Refusenik, a Jewish Student's Survival Guide. And we'll have a visit from Tom Price, our expert on the international Jewish scene. Please email your comments to us at TooJewishRadio18@gmail.com or visit us on the web at TooJewishRadio.com. The opinions of the host and guests on Too Jewish are their own and not those of the radio station. Too Jewish is paid for by Too Jewish Radio Programs and Podcasts, Tucson, Arizona. And now, here's Rabbi Sam Kohan and Too Jewish.
Shalom. Last week on my birthday, I was watching a comedy clip of two prominent Jewish comedians dueling with jokes, Ilan Gold and Moti Rosenfeld. They were demonstrating the ways Israelis are always one-upping each other. Ilan Gold says, "You know, Startup Nation, I started that." Moti Rosenfeld says, "That's nothing. I told Ben-Gurion, you know how to make money? Build an airport." And then Ilan Gold says, "You know Ben-Gurion? I knew his father, Gurion." So Moti Rosenfeld says, "You know Bibi? I know when he's just B. I told him, change it to BB. You'll be huge." Ilan Gold answers, "Ach, I knew him when he was A." Jewish leadership is dependent, apparently, on such genius. In synagogue, we're now reading the Torah portions at the beginning of Shmot, the book of Exodus, and early on, we're introduced to the single most important leader in the history of our entire people. Indeed, perhaps in the history of Western civilization. Moses will become the great liberator of the Israelites and the model for nearly every liberation movement ever after. He will also emerge as the lawgiver who transmits God's great code of ethics, morality, and ritual into a system that still forms the basis of all monotheistic belief and practice, not to mention the foundation of civilized law. And of course, Moses is the one who helps forge a lost, polyglot group of slaves into a nation. Surely he can give us great lessons in what it takes to be a leader. And yet, the more that you study Moses' career, the more you explore his character and methodology, the more you wonder how this ever came to be. For Moses' greatness, while indisputable, is completely unpredictable based on any reasonable process for choosing or training a leader. In fact, you can make a case that Moses' birth, rearing, adolescence, and most of his adulthood should have led to a life of dubious importance and no real value. Moses is born early on in Exodus, and his character development over these early portions, you would think, would provide a wonderful instructional guide to the growth and evolution of a leader. If this is our greatest figure, shouldn't we be able to learn from his life how to create great leaders? Shouldn't Shmot, Exodus, serve as a primer for the best-selling business book, Moses on Management, or perhaps How to Raise a Heroic, Courageous Child? But here are the simple facts of his life. Moses, third child of slave parents, is born in the midst of an attempted genocide being perpetrated against all Israelite boys. His mother hides him, no doubt shushing him constantly, until he is too loud to keep secret. He's then sneakily abandoned in a little boat, an ark, saved from drowning or exposure or being eaten by crocodiles by the daughter of a king, who names him and then immediately hands him off to a wet nurse, actually back to his slave mom who dumped him in the first place. When he reaches adolescence, he's suddenly brought to the Pharaoh's palace and taught the basics of Egyptian court conduct, which he apparently never really grasps. One day, he sees a slave being beaten, a legal act then, and instinctively reacts by killing the taskmaster, a kind of Egyptian cop. He then tries to bury his homicide victim in the sand. This is illegal even for a prince, and when he sees Israelites fighting the next day and tries to stop them, they make it clear his murderous deed is known. Next, Moses becomes a fugitive from justice, running away to the desert of Midian in the Sinai. Again, he becomes involved in an altercation, fighting with some shepherds. This time, he picks the right side, is brought into the non-Israelite household of a Midianite priest. He settles down with a pretty wild woman there, marries her, has two kids, and is working for his father-in-law as a humble shepherd in an empty, barren, meaningless corner of the world. Not much of a CV for a future world leader. Abandoned by his real parents, a manslayer, a wanted fugitive from justice, employed in one of the most obscure places and one of the lowest occupations the ancient world offered, in the desert no less. No prominent family, no prep schools, no great grades, no internships, no national merit scholarships, no Ivy League colleges, no law schools or MBAs, no fellowships. Not much of anything, to be honest, to recommend him. Ah, and I forgot a basic fact. He was a poor speaker, apparently, a stutterer, or maybe just somebody who slurred his words badly. And yet, this is the guy who God chooses to lead our people from slavery to freedom, from doubt and darkness to revelation and holiness. This is the one who the Almighty decides will forge our nation and bring us to the entrance of the Promised Land. The choice is so bizarre, so profoundly unlikely, that when God speaks to Moses from that famous burning bush and tells him he will lead the campaign to let my people go, Moses himself can't believe it. He argues vigorously that God is making a huge mistake choosing him, that the Lord should choose someone else, anybody else, in fact. By the way, Moses' ability to lead is so rudimentary that even after the Exodus, when he's led the greatest liberation in human history to that point, he insists on judging every single law case himself. He has not yet discovered the concept of delegation. You can see the next three books of the Torah as a kind of casebook of Moses' learning how to do the job God's given him and struggling with it still to the end of his life. So, what was God thinking here? Why choose a black sheep troublemaker like Moses when there had to be better bred, more skilled, more obvious and prominent candidates for leadership? The answer lies in the fact that Moses was chosen to lead the Jewish people, and that is perhaps a different kind of task, requiring different skills than leadership of any other group. What ultimately matters in Jewish leadership may not be the same thing that matters in other kinds of leadership, and until we understand that crucial fact, we will never understand the genius God demonstrated in picking Moses. First, in order to lead Jews, a certain core integrity is essential. Moses may not always show the best judgment or present the calmest front in times of crisis, but throughout Exodus, and then through his whole career, he remains true to his central values. He always trusts in God. He knows right from wrong. When he sees injustice or persecution, he acts. Moses has that integrity. He never loses it. Second, to be a Jewish leader, you need passion. We've always been a passionate people, passionate about everything, from food to music to religion to justice to rights to nationalism. We're not always right, but we are always passionate. To lead such a group, you must care deeply and have the energy and spirit to demonstrate that passion. Moses has a terrible temper. He's often outraged, sometimes fierce, but his passion must be respected. Third, and perhaps most importantly, to become a successful Jewish leader, you must have goals and continue to seek to achieve them, no matter the odds, no matter the obstacles. It takes 10 plagues to free the Israelites, a great crossing of an impassable sea to reach freedom, and an incredible covenant of fire, smoke, and drama at Mount Sinai to become a people. And then it took 40 more years to get to the Promised Land. To lead Jews takes commitment and patience, and the ability to keep your eye on the real goals without being distracted and dissuaded by temporary setbacks. What was it David Ben-Gurion said? In Israel, in order to be a realist, you must believe in miracles. Jewish leadership in its essence is the ability to pragmatically work to create, well, miracles. And finally, leading Jews takes having the ability to grow and change without abandoning integrity, losing your passion, or forsaking your goals. In the course of these Torah portions, and certainly through the rest of the Torah, Moses learns management. He delegates, becomes an orator, learns to organize groups, learns how to motivate this complex, difficult people. He never stops arguing, of course, even with God. Especially with God, because he knows that what matters most is accomplishing what is right and good and holy. Later, Moses even makes some small compromises in the interests of peace. Small compromises, mind you, because the essence of Moses' leadership is not compromise. It is integrity, passion, and goal orientation. Isn't that still the formula for true leadership? Especially Jewish leadership. To play us in this morning, here is a passage from the Shabbat morning liturgy, Yismach Moshe. Moses rejoiced in his portion, God's faithful servant, and his portion, of course, included leading the Israelites. Yismach Moshe. That was a Hasidic version of Yismach Moshe, Moses rejoiced in his portion. We'll return in a moment here on Two Jewish. Our guest this morning will be Isabella Tabarovsky, born in the Soviet Union, today the Cannon Institute Senior Advisor on Regional Partnerships and Programming, an expert on how Soviet anti-Semitism and anti-Zionism has been exported and feeds contemporary anti-Semitism throughout the political left. She's the author of Be a Refusnik, A Jewish Student's Survival Guide. Meet her. Learn how we can respond to this contemporary scourge when we come back in a moment on Too Jewish.
Introducing Taste of Judaism, offering everything you ever wanted to know about Judaism but never got to ask. Who was Abraham? What is the Torah? How long have Jews been around? What do Jews believe about life after death? Where does the concept of Brit covenant come from? In three upbeat, fun, inexpensive, informative sessions, Taste of Judaism brings the joy of Jewish life and learning to you. You'll study with Rabbi Sam Kohan and learn what Jewish values, spirituality, and community are all about, and have a great sample of delicious Jewish foods. Classes are offered at La Cholla and Tangerine in Oro Valley, and all classes are open to everyone, Jewish or not. Best of all, Taste of Judaism is offered free of charge, but you must pre-register. No cost to you, and the learning is invaluable. Free, but you must pre-register by calling 520-276-5676 or emailing execbeitsimcha@gmail.com or going to www.beitsimcha.tucson.org and signing up. Hundreds of thousands of students worldwide have taken Taste of Judaism. Why not join them? No obligation, just an energetic and great instructor, free food, fun, and a wonderful introduction to Jewish life. Call 520-276-5675 to register for Taste of Judaism, the most popular and effective introduction to Jewish learning and life. Call 520-276-5675 for your very own Taste of Judaism.
We are delighted to welcome the Two Jewish, our guest this morning. Isabella Tabarovsky is the author of a new book, Be a Refusnik, A Jewish Student's Survival Guide. It's a fascinating and unusual and very helpful book, and something that I think could only have been written by someone who had experience in the former Soviet Union. Good morning and welcome to Two Jewish.
Good morning. Thank you so much for having me.
So I wanted to talk a little bit about the origins or the effectiveness of Soviet anti-Semitism and how it was a deliberate effort to promulgate it, spread it throughout particularly the Arab world, but really everywhere. Can you tell us a little bit about that? I don't think most Americans know that.
Sure, happy to. And just to be clear, it normally takes me a couple hours to explain it, but but I'll try to be brief. So, you know, the anti-Zionism that we're facing today very much originates in Soviet propaganda. And the Soviets were always anti-Zionist from the very beginning, from the early Bolshevik years, but their anti-Zionism shifted over the years. It evolved and changed and acquired different forms. And the form that we're talking about today really goes back to the post-1967 era, the years that followed or really began very soon after Israel won in the Six-Day War. It won over Soviet Arab allies, and it was extremely alarming for the Soviets. And so they really came to the conclusion, and I think that they really believed it, that Zionists were extremely powerful. The Zionist ideology had taken over America, and so it needed to be fought everywhere around the world. And they devised a propaganda machine that really addressed this issue. You know, it was completely conspiracy thinking. They were imagining it in the same way that anti-Semites in, the right-wing anti-Semites on the far right imagined the Jews control the world. But they really believed it. And so they came up with this whole set of slogans, among other things, that are so familiar to us today, equating Zionism with racism, with Nazism, with fascism, equating Israel with apartheid South Africa, claiming that Israel is committing genocide against Palestinians. You know, all these things that a lot of people today are calling new anti-Semitism, you actually already see them in Soviet propaganda already in the 1950s, but certainly en masse and intentionally after 1967.
It's really stunning, and that has certainly taken root in a profound way on our college campuses, really in a whole generation or two of people educated there. We'll talk much more with the, how can I put it best, I guess the Soviet anti-Semitism expert, Isabella Taborowski, and the author of a really terrific new book called Be a Refusenik, when we come back in a moment here on Too Jewish. The stories we share last a lifetime and are passed down from generation to generation. Known for our compassionate commitment to the families we serve, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has faithfully served the Tucson community and the Jewish community for over 100 years. We help thousands of families plan and carry out celebrations of loved ones in unique and special ways and assist them in sharing those lifetimes of stories meaningfully. The most beautiful and tranquil final resting place in all of southern Arizona, Evergreen's tall pines shade peaceful grassy fields. You can count on Evergreen for superior service and the highest degree of integrity. Our informative, well-trained staff is here to assist you with a full range of on-site services. Call Evergreen, 520-888-7470, 520-888-7470. While we serve the whole community, our experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox, is second to none. We have sections dedicated to all religious faiths, can help you arrange for your future needs or your immediate ones. Whether you choose to hold a traditional funeral service or a completely individualized ceremony, either in person or online or both, our goal is to help you create a meaningful, personalized service based upon your unique needs in a place of reflection, tradition, and serenity. Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best to the community and to you. Call 520-888-7470. To speak to a family advisor at Evergreen, call 520-888-7470. We welcome our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Rabbi.
So, just a funny topic today. I remember the last time I went to Shabbat services at the synagogue in Stockholm, which was very impressive. First of all, Friday night services started at 10 p.m. in the summer, which was just, they declared it then because it was going to be light till like 2 a.m. You just have to decide. And I remember looking around and seeing people in the kind of the Stockholm Jews wearing top hat and tails, some of them, for Erev Shabbat, not because it was a fancy occasion, but because it was Shabbat. There are sure a lot of different customs for what you wear to shul, aren't there?
Absolutely. I mean, when you mention top hat and tails, I immediately think of the Spanish-Portuguese synagogue in London, because once I was best man at a wedding there, and I had to rent exactly those things, a top hat and tails, to attend the wedding in this synagogue where that standard attire for any major service or simcha or whatever. So I'm sure it's standard attire on Shabbat and on all the chagim and for weddings.
Pretty nice. Now, I'll give you the other end of the spectrum. When I was in Tel Aviv a few years ago, I went to the beach Shabbat. They do a really fun Kabbalat Shabbat and then really a whole service out on the beach there in the summer. And I wouldn't say it was clothing optional, but I went in swim trunks and flip-flops, and that was pretty close to as much as anybody was wearing. It was still Shabbat. It was still really lovely. And, you know, just kind of interesting variations. What other kinds of traditions have you seen in other places?
You know, pretty much anything you can imagine. In Europe, by and large, people dress the way their peers dress. So there's not like a special sartorial tradition for attending synagogues other than, and probably the British wear top hat and tails much more often than we do anyway. So
I can personally vouch that I have, although many times, had to wear tuxedos for weddings or New Year's things or something. I have never worn a top hat or tails.
Well, my boast used to be that I survived a whole career in the Foreign Service and served with some distinction without ever having to wear a tuxedo. I was very proud of that. I declined events where tuxedos were required, and I would trade off and make it like a win-win because, for example, the annual Marine Corps birthday ball is celebrated at every embassy in the world because it's the Marines who provide security to embassies. So they need people to cover their duties and their posts during this big bash, which lasts like 12 hours. So I would always volunteer for at least one or two shifts covering for Marine so that he or she could attend the birthday ball, but it was also so that I could avoid
having to put on a tuxedo.
Right.
It's funny. I mean, when you go to various services and various places, you really do see such an incredible variety of, as you said, sartorial traditions. When I was in Sydney, Australia, and served there, like, men always wore ties Friday night, even in the Reform congregation, which wasn't formal in many ways. And yet, when I do services in Tucson, I'm almost always the only person wearing a tie.
Right. Well, Tucson is a special place. I will say, once I went for the high holiday to the synagogue in New Delhi, and more than any place on earth, because New Delhi is the capital of a very big country. It has a huge expatriate community, which includes a certain percentage of Jews. And, you know, like everywhere else, Jews come out of the woodwork for the high holidays. So that room looked like a meeting of the United Nations in terms of how people looked physically, their facial characteristics, but also in terms of what they were wearing. I mean, there were people in like Indian turbans and people in sort of Nehru shirts. And it was like the whole gamut. It was a very impressive and very diverse gathering. And that reflected itself in the way that people dressed.
Tom, thanks so much. We will talk next week.
I look forward to it.
Introducing Taste of Judaism, offering everything you ever wanted to know about Judaism but never got to ask. Who was Abraham? What is the Torah? How long have Jews been around? What do Jews believe about life after death? Where does the concept of Brit Covenant come from? In three upbeat, fun, inexpensive, informative sessions, Taste of Judaism brings the joy of Jewish life and learning to you. You'll study with Rabbi Sam Kohan and learn what Jewish values, spirituality, and community are all about, and have a great sample of delicious Jewish foods. Classes are offered at La Cholla and Tangerine in Oro Valley, and all classes are open to everyone, Jewish or not. Best of all, Taste of Judaism is offered free of charge, but you must pre-register. No cost to you, and the learning is invaluable.
free, but you must pre-register by calling 520-276-5676 or emailing execbaitsimka@gmail.com or going to www.baitsimkatucson.org and signing up. Hundreds of thousands of students worldwide have taken Taste of Judaism. Why not join them? No obligation, just an energetic and great instructor, free food, fun, and a wonderful introduction to Jewish life. Call 520-276-5675 to register for Taste of Judaism, the most popular and effective introduction to Jewish learning and life. Call 520-276-5675 for your very own Taste of Judaism.
It's time now for our old Jewish joke of the week, Jewish humor, your Bubby and Zadie knew, brought to you by Too Jewish as a public service. Levy had finally made it big, and in the ongoing competition with the other machers at the shul, he finally hit on the idea of a truly unique bar mitzvah for his son. A safari, he told everybody. I'll fly the whole congregation to Africa. The natives will chant as my son sings his haftorah. On the appointed day, some 400 Jews were flown 18 hours to Africa in first class. Guides schlepped their extensive baggage. The guests threaded their way through the jungle atop specially trained elephants wearing giant leopard print yarmulkes emblazoned with Levy Bar Mitzvah Safari. Suddenly, the column halted. There will be a delay of 1 hour, the guide announced. What do you mean? Levy demanded indignantly. The guide shrugged. The Goldberg Bar Mitzvah is running a little long. You see, the Goldberg Bar Mitzvah was ahead of them, and that was the old Jewish joke of the week, special feature of Too Jewish just for you. You should live and be well. And now a word of Torah. This week, our people gets out of Egypt, or to be more accurate, we chant the Torah portion of Bo, which includes the description of the actual exodus from Egyptian slavery and the establishment of the rites and rituals of the observance of the Passover. The build-up to this week's portion has been steady and dramatic. Plague followed plague. 10, of course, rising in severity as the one God overcomes the long roster of Egyptian gods and idols and frees the people of Israel from their long night of oppression and slavery. Finally, in this portion of Bo, our ancestors become a free people. Since we are now liberated, you might expect us Jews to immediately cast off the memory of oppression and enslavement, moving on to new and better things, to reject our history of degradation. Oddly, God, through Moses, commands us to do quite the opposite, to remember the slavery and how we were freed only by God's great acts. And from this point on, we're reminded repeatedly to remember those in our own society who are oppressed and to help them, because after all, we ourselves were slaves in the land of Egypt. You are strangers in a strange land, we tell ourselves repeatedly in the Torah. Therefore, recalling our degradation, we must help the oppressed and the strangers in our own land. I can think of no other people or nation that spends so much effort remembering how humble its origins are. Unlike so many other national myths, we Jews do not highlight our ancient and sacred pedigree or our divine origin. Instead, we remind ourselves again and again, that we are the descendants of slaves who have nothing to call their own. Even on holidays that have nothing to do with the Exodus or the story of freedom, we include the memory of slavery and liberation. Every Kiddush on every single Shabbat includes the phrase that we are celebrating Zecher Letziat Mitzrayim, remembering the Exodus from Egyptian slavery. That message is powerful. We must recall the fact of our own oppression so that we will identify with those in our own world who need help. The Seder of Bo teaches us we must seek always to redeem the world through our own actions. Our connection is with the lowly. Our efforts to heal the world come from the knowledge that we ourselves have come up from exactly that background. It's a profound lesson in humility that leads directly to charity, to tzedakah, and the promulgation of righteousness in the world. even in challenging times. Perhaps especially in challenging times, we must remember those who are oppressed and who have less than we. And no matter how much we rise in the world, no matter how influential or powerful our people might become or our Jewish nation might be, we are always to identify with those who have less and need our help. When we return in a moment on To Jewish, our guest, Isabella Taborowski, who in her academic work has traced how Nazi anti-Semitism became Soviet Union anti-Semitism and anti-Zionism, and that they're both being used to fuel contemporary anti-Semitism, tells us how we can best respond. Find out when we return in a moment on To Jewish.
We continue with our To Jewish update on news of Jews around the world with commentary from Rabbi Sam Kohan.
The largest synagogue in Mississippi, Jackson's Beth Israel congregation, was badly burned in a deliberate arson attack by a 19-year-old man who later confessed his crimes to law enforcement and referred to the building as the Synagogue of Satan. Stephen Spencer Pittman, 19 years old, of Madison, Mississippi, is facing federal charges for using fire to maliciously damage or destroy a building involved in interstate commerce, according to a probable cause affidavit filed in the U.S. Southern District of Mississippi. The Beth Israel Congregation Synagogue building also houses the offices of the Institute for Southern Jewish Life, which provides school programs and traveling rabbinical services to smaller Jewish congregations across the South. Beth Israel has 140 member families. The pre-dawn fire last Shabbat reduced the historic synagogue's library and administrative offices to charred ruins and left smoke damage throughout the building, the same one that the Ku Klux Klan bombed back in 1967 for its rabbi's support of civil rights. Two Torah scrolls were destroyed, although the congregation's Holocaust Torah survived the fire intact since it was in a protected glass case. In a striking parallel, Pittman set fire to the same part of the octagonal building in Jackson that burned in the 1967 attack by the Klan. Pittman was hospitalized for his burns. He appeared in federal court by video. When the judge asked him if he understood his rights to an attorney, Pittman responded, "Yes, sir, Jesus Christ is Lord." At his arraignment, Pittman's hands were wrapped in bandages. If convicted, Pittman faces 5 to 20 years in prison and a fine of up to $250,000. Beth Israel congregation thanked investigators for swiftly apprehending the suspect, said it's noteworthy that he appears to have admitted to committing this heinous act out of hatred for the Jewish people. This news puts a face and name to this tragedy, but does not change our resolve to proudly, even defiantly, continue Jewish life in Jackson in the face of hatred, the congregation said. The response and support from our community, both from local churches and the worldwide Jewish community, has been overwhelming. Federal investigators quickly identified Pittman as a person of interest, according to the affidavit, which includes text messages he sent to his father in the course of setting the fire. His father pleaded for the son to return home, but Pittman replied back, saying he was due for a home run, and I did my research. Pittman confessed to his father, who later contacted the FBI and provided GPS data showing Pittman was at the synagogue early Saturday. The son laughed as he told his father what he did and said he finally got them. Pittman purchased gasoline from Max Gas in Ridgeland, where he also removed the license plate from his truck. He then drove to the synagogue, used an axe to break through a window, went inside, poured gasoline, and lit it on fire with a torch lighter. Once at Beth Israel, Pittman texted his father a photo of the back of the synagogue, writing, "There's a furnace in the back." Investigators recovered a burnt cell phone, believed to be Pittman's, and a hand torch. Jackson Mayor John Horn said the suspect drove himself to a hospital after he was burned, that is, he burned himself, setting the fire. He added, "There's a possibility the suspect will be charged with a hate crime. That seems like a likelihood. We thought Mississippi was beyond that sort of thing," said the Jackson mayor. News of the arson drew an outpouring of local support for Beth Israel. The mayor, multiple city council members, religious institutions, and elected officials all condemned the attack, which caught the attention of top officials at the U.S. Department of Justice. Lieutenant Governor Delbert Hosemann, a Republican who lives near the synagogue, condemned the attack. The burning of Beth Israel Synagogue was an act of religious hatred against a place meant to offer prayerful peace and comfort, Hosemann said. This is not only an attack on a house of worship,
than an offense against the religious freedom protected by our Constitution. Such acts threaten all of us, regardless of faith. The perpetrator should be prosecuted to the fullest extent of the law. Mississippi House Speaker Jason White said the fire was a horrible act that must be condemned. It's awful and terrible. It's also a reflection on where we are as a society. Intolerance finds its way in a lot of different places. Harmeet Dhillon, the U.S. Department of Justice's Assistant Attorney General for Civil Rights, said that she was personally involved, and my team is in touch with the U.S. Attorney's Office in Jackson. Beth Israel has established a donation fund for rebuilding with a link on the congregation's website. You can help by going to BethIsraelMS.org. That's BethIsraelMS, MS for Mississippi.org. And that's the news of Jews around the world. We welcome back to Two Jewish. Our guest this morning, Isabella Taborowski. She's written a valuable new book about addressing anti-Semitism called Be a Refusenik, particularly important for young people right now. Tell us a little bit about the experience of young people going to college campuses now and how this book could be valuable and what they ought to do.
Well, another complex question, of course. You know, when
I'm sorry, we only ask complex questions. This is a Jewish show. You have to understand.
I completely understand, and I love it. So in the book, in Be a Refusenik, I actually tell two stories in parallel, but they're also, I find them to be quite deeply intertwined. So one, of course, is the story of the Refuseniks, the Jewish heroes in the late USSR essentially rejected the model that they proposed to Jews, which is, you know, you can be fully assimilated, you can be okay here as a Jew, just don't bring in your Zionism, don't bring in your religion, don't bring in any of your Jewish culture, and then you'll be okay here. Essentially, be a Jew without being a Jew. And in many ways, and so that's the first story that I tell. The book is really stories of these incredible heroes who refused to do that and refused to separate themselves from the Jewish people. That was really the main thing that the Soviets demanded. They rejected the idea that Jews were a people.
Even though they stamped Yevrei on everybody's passport, right?
Exactly. That's exactly right. Yeah, there are a lot of contradictions in this, and that we can't really get into them in the time that we have.
Sure.
But
sure.
But yes, absolutely. And they would argue, you know, when American Jews stood up for Soviet Jews, they would say, well, these are different Jews. Our Soviet Jews are not like American Jews, and they're not like Israeli Jews. It's a whole different species, basically, is what they're saying. And there's no such thing as a Jewish people. And then the second story that I tell in Be a Refusenik is the story of several American Jewish activists today, some of whom are household names today, such as Shabbos Kestenbaum, such as Eyal Yacobi, Adela Kohav, and there are several others. And what I say in the book is that, extraordinarily enough, these young people have landed on some of the same strategies that those refuseniks in the Soviet times did, which is, what is the model of resistance? What is the model of Jewish resistance that they land on? One is, you reclaim your Zionism. It's exactly what the Soviet Jews, who were activist refuseniks, not all refuseniks, but the activists among them and the leaders of the movement, it's exactly what they did. They said, you, the ideologues, are telling us that we need to give up our Zionism. Well, we are reclaiming it. This is what some of the young people, many of the young people today are doing. We see it in the letter that Lisha Baker at Columbia University co-authored with other students, where it was literally, the whole letter was this, we're reclaiming our Zionism. They re-insist on their connection with the Jewish people, the young people today who are activists. You know, they essentially go against everything. They reject the idea of victimhood. You know, this is really important because the refuseniks in Soviet times, you could say they were victims of state oppression, but they did not think of themselves as victims.
You know, Sharansky wrote the foreword to your book, of course. He's such an extraordinary figure. There are so many people who came to the United States and to Israel and to Canada, really everywhere in the world, refuseniks who eventually got out with after the collapse of the Soviet Union. You would think that those lessons would be internalized. And this is a delicate question. Former Soviet Union Jews have a
many were courageous about affirming their Judaism, but many come to other places, and Judaism is a secondary consideration. They weren't raised with it. Is that the same mentality for people raised in soft American settings, for example?
You know, this is a really interesting question, because when I first came to the U.S., and I first finally took me a long time to kind of create my own connection, to connect to the Jewish community here in America, because it was a very difficult moment. As you say, you know, being a Soviet Jew was very different from being an American Jew. But when I finally connected, I said, well, you know, we grew up knowing nothing, no Hebrew, nothing. And a lot of people would tell me, look, we grew up the same way. We also knew nothing. And I always used to dismiss it. But actually, to be honest with you, today, I think I take it more seriously. And I understand what they mean. So yes, I think there is a similarity. But you know what's interesting about ex-Soviet Jews is that a lot of us came to America. And yes, many people assimilated and just moved on. But what's interesting is that today, ex-Soviet Jews are ones who understand most clearly, you know, with exceptional clarity, that what we're facing today is a form of anti-Semitism. I think it's something that it took American-born Jews to understand. It took them a long time to understand. You know, I've been writing about it for years and warning about this. I've been saying for years that once you start demonizing Zionists, you are very quickly going to start having anti-Semitic outcomes, because it's going to spread to every Jew. And I think this is what we're seeing today. But it took American-born Jews a long time to understand. Today, the organizations that I find to be grassroots organizations that I find to be most effective in confronting what we're facing are organizations that were started by ex-Soviet Jews. There are several. There's Club Z. There is the Jewish Parent Academy. You know, I've just had sort of a number of talks, kind of a very quick book tour, first phase of the book tour, and really that crowd and the children, their American-born children that they bring, they really see what's happening, and they're bringing their children in that spirit. You know, that you don't submit to this. There are forces that want to oppress you as a Jew when they tell you that Zionism is Nazism or something. So it's a very interesting moment in which I think ex-Soviet Jews now get to step forward and lead with their understanding of the current moment.
Young American Jews, there's sort of a generational divide right now between older American Jews' attitudes towards Israel and towards seeing this as clearly anti-Semitic, the Qatari-funded anti-Zionist movement all over the world, all the soft power ways that has been utilized. Without using too many buzzwords, how do we explain this to college-age kids? Because your stories are powerful. What's the best way for those of us who are dealing with this in our own congregations, sometimes in our own families?
Yeah. Look, I don't think I have a simple answer to this, and I don't think there is a simple answer. We are dealing really with a generational problem, and I don't think that it's simply, it does go back to, it's not like, okay, here's a new generation that views things differently. This is a generation that has been influenced to think this way. I think that we as Jews are facing a political warfare campaign, you know, a psychological warfare campaign that's geared not just at Israel, not only at Israel, but also at us everywhere. And one of the objectives is to tear our children away from their people. I think it's one of the, and it is what we're seeing today.
The stories that are woven through here, these are people who were raised in a secular society, that's incorrect, in a deliberately atheistic society, right? That's a fair statement about anywhere in the former Soviet Union. And who found their Jewish identities because, as a form of rebellion.
Yes.
It seems to me that today, and without talking too much kind of theoretically, what young people are seeing is the rebellion is against Israel or against a pro-Jewish stand. And they don't see that it's really not just about Israel. It's really about being Jewish and Jews in general. When you were putting this together and kind of digging into some of these stories, I guess I keep coming back to hard and soft. it seems like. I kept feeling it all the way through. You know, Josef Begun, people who are like secretly, my parents were people who smuggled Jewish books into Hebrew books and prayer books and taluses into the Soviet Union at one point as part of the major effort, a small part of a big effort. The courage that it took to defy the KGB and teach yourself Hebrew is stunning.
Yes, yes.
Is there a way of reframing the battle now as the same kind of underdog story that is so appealing to young people?
Well, look, I think it is an underdog story. You know, just because there is no state apparatus going after you doesn't mean that the punishment you may experience is less. I mean, it's of course physically, comparatively, if you compare the two directly, there, of course, the severity of the punishment is very different. Nobody's going to throw these young people into a gulag. However, the you know, every society has its own kind of measurement of what's the worst punishment that you can experience. So for these young people, for young people in general, being excluded from their social circle, being shamed by their professors, which is what we see all the time, not being able to express themselves, potentially losing job and career opportunities. That's very, very real. I mean, I think that that's a real danger that they face. And so in that sense, look, all the faculties have pretty much taken over, in all elite universities at least, are taken over by anti-Zionist faculty. So you have to, you know, Natan Sharansky talks about it all the time, that today young people are having to be these little double thinkers, which is very painfully familiar to those of us who grew up in the USSR. You think one thing, but you have to say another thing. So, you know, so I think in a lot of ways it is really rebellious to reclaim your Jewish identity. And to be honest with you, I think a lot of young people are experiencing it that way. You know, we see, you know, spikes of anti-Semitism do produce, as we don't like to think about it that way. We want to think that Judaism will just be attractive on its own terms. But anti-Semitism does produce a greater interest and motivation to belong and at least a consideration. You know, people start thinking, well, why is there such anger? Why is there such hatred? And they think back to their families and they rethink things. So I think that it will happen. You know, it may happen to a minority at first, but here I allow myself to be a little bit optimistic, and it's part of why I think this story is very optimistic, is that it actually shows that it doesn't take a whole lot of people to change culture. And a small number of people can change culture for the worse, but it also can change culture for the best. You know, when you look at the number of activist refuseniks, the refuseniks, the leaders of that movement, how many were there? I would say maximum a couple hundred. If you look at the names that American Jews fought for, maybe there were a dozen, maybe a couple dozen.
If that many, actually.
If that many, that's right. But they were not the only ones. And I mentioned it in the book, you know, and I've been thinking about it in the kind of, I have this model of concentric circles in my mind. So at the heart of it is the activist. So in our paradigm, in America today, we can think of Shabbos Kestenbaum, Eyal Yacobi, Adela Kohav as being in that center of activists who really place everything on the line. You know, when they go against these massive institutions, when they get loud, they really put everything on the line in that moment. But everybody can't do it, and they don't need to. So around them, so in Soviet times, there were maybe several thousand of those who were very close to the movement, to the next concentric circle, who supported them while they were in prison, who communicated with people like your parents. So maybe there were several thousand of them. And then around them, an even bigger concentric circle, there were, let's say, tens of thousands. We don't really know the number, but tens of thousands of those who were also refused permission to emigrate. And even those who were not, they just joined this movement because they refused to acquiesce to the reality that the state demanded them to acquiesce to. And they maybe did very small things. You know, maybe some of them took some of the self-published magazines about Jewish identity, for example, and carried them from one train station from the train station where they got delivered into the home of the Hebrew teachers, who then distributed them. Small act, not so hugely risky, but really crucial when a lot of people do it. Some became this informal correspondence where they would anonymously report from a city like Baku in Azerbaijan what was going on in the Jewish community there. And so even the leaders of the movement didn't know and still don't know some of their names. So, and for some, it could have been just, you know, talking, as I already said earlier, talking to their children in the kitchen and saying what you just heard at school or read in the newspaper or heard on television about Israel as an aggressor state that oppresses Palestinians and conducts genocide. You know, this is not true. This is reality. This, too, is a small act of resistance. And so that's what I'm saying is that we don't need everyone to become like Shabbos Kestenbaum, but we need a lot of people to feel empowered to believe that it's really important, not to believe, but to recognize that they're part of a Jewish people, that there is a massive propaganda campaign being geared against us, and to want to resist it.
I want to thank Isabella Tomorowski for a great visit here on Too Jewish. Where can people go to find out more about the book, Be a Refusenik, and to find out more about you?
So the book is available on Amazon in paperback and on Kindle format. So if you just look for me, for my name and the name of the book, Be a Refusenik, a Jewish Student Survival Guide there, you can find it. You can find it. I'm on social media. I'm on Facebook. I'm on Twitter. My handle is Iza Tabaro, I-Z-A-T-A-B-A. And I'm part of the Z3 Institute, which is an institute that's located in the Oshman's ACC in Palo Alto. So you can look for events with me there. And thank you so much for having me. It's a real pleasure.
It's an honor. The stories we share last a lifetime and are passed down from generation to generation. Known for our compassionate commitment to the families we serve, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has faithfully served the Tucson community and the Jewish community for over 100 years. We help thousands of families plan and carry out celebrations of loved ones in unique and special ways and assist them in sharing those lifetimes of stories meaningfully. The most beautiful and tranquil final resting place in all of southern Arizona, Evergreen's tall pines shade peaceful grassy fields. You can count on Evergreen for superior service and the highest degree of integrity. Our informative, well-trained staff is here to assist you with a full range of on-site services. Call Evergreen, 520-888-7470, 520-888-7470. While we serve the whole community, our experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox, is second to none. We have sections dedicated to all religious faiths, can help you arrange for your future needs or your immediate ones. Whether you choose to hold a traditional funeral service or a completely individualized ceremony, either in person or online or both, our goal is to help you create a meaningful, personalized service based upon your unique needs in a place of reflection, tradition, and serenity. Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best to the community and to you. Call 520-888-7470. To speak to a family advisor at Evergreen, call 520-888-7470.
Introducing Taste of Judaism, offering everything you ever wanted to know about Judaism but never got to ask. Who was Abraham? What is the Torah? How long have Jews been around? What do Jews believe about life after death? Where does the concept of Brit, covenant, come from? In three upbeat, fun, inexpensive, informative sessions, Taste of Judaism brings the joy of Jewish life and learning to you. You'll study with Rabbi Sam Kohan and learn what Jewish values, spirituality, and community are all about, and have a great sample of delicious Jewish foods. Classes are offered at La Cholla and Tangerine in Oro Valley, and all classes are open to everyone, Jewish or not. Best of all, Taste of Judaism is offered free of charge, but you must pre-register. No cost to you, and the learning is invaluable. Free, but you must pre-register by calling 520-276-5676 or emailing execbeitsimcha@gmail.com or going to www.beitsimchatucson.org and signing up. Hundreds of thousands of students worldwide have taken Taste of Judaism. Why not join them? No obligation, just an energetic and great instructor, free food, fun, and a wonderful introduction to Jewish life.
Call 520-276-5675 to register for Taste of Judaism, the most popular and effective introduction to Jewish learning and life. Call 520-276-5675 for your very own Taste of Judaism.
Thanks for being here with us this morning on Too Jewish with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan. Join us next week. My friends, have a Shavua Tov, a good week, a healthy week, and a week we pray profoundly of peace.
Too Jewish is sponsored by Too Jewish Radio Programs, Tucson, Arizona.